Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be looking for lost fathers and their impact by way of memoir. A word originated from memory, which means to be kept in mind. Our first memoir will take us from Virginia Beach to New Orleans, where a son pieces together the reasons his alcoholic father left his family.
Each night I prayed for his return. Often I asked my mother, "When's Daddy coming back?" She always said, "I don't know." After about 3 years, I finally asked, "Is Daddy ever coming back?" She said, "No, I don't think so."
In the second half hour, our second memoir will take us from Crossett, Arkansas, to Oxford, England, and back to Little Rock, as a son meets his birth father for the first time.
In 45 minutes, the phone on my desk would be ringing, and on the other end of the line would be the voice of my father, a voice I had never known in my conscious life. What would it sound like? What would he say? What would I say?
Arts and Letters up next, but first, news. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters. Our first guest is UALR Rhetoric and Writing Professor and Chair Dr. George Jensen, who will talk about his memoir, Some of the Words Are Theirs, A Memoir of an Alcoholic Family, which describes what it means to come to an understanding of the limitations of the stories we tell by listening to the words of others in order to reclaim and reconstitute heartache and loss. George Jensen, Rhetoric and Writing Department Chair, Professor, Memoirist, welcome.
Thank you, Brad.
You told a simple story to yourself early on. Your father went to AA for 6 months. Then he came home one night and said that he didn't think he was an addict. Then he left. Could you trace the best you can what happened?
Well, he left our family when I was about 7 and a half. I actually thought it was 6 years old. I was 6 years old when he left, but I found from documents that I was actually 7 and a half, kind of closer to being 8 years old than 6 years old. My mother asked him to leave, and he told me, he brought me in from playing, basically said, "Daddy's going on a business trip. I'll be gone for a while." And I assumed he would be gone for about 2 weeks. I don't really even have any memory of him departing. Each night I prayed for his return. Often I asked my mother, "When's Daddy coming back?" She always said, "I don't know." After about 3 years, I finally asked, "Is Daddy ever coming back?" She said, "No, I don't think so." I never had to ask about my father again, and I'm sure my mother was relieved to be done with the silly lie about a business trip taken by a man who didn't even have a job. He apparently took a bus from Virginia Beach, Virginia, all the way to Washington, state of Washington, stayed with his mother for a while, but she was on a very fixed income, and he felt bad about staying with her, so he moved in with his brother, my Uncle Frosty, and stayed there for a while. And the story I heard about his stay there from my cousin was that one day he and Frosty, who was also an alcoholic, decided to start drinking, and then they started making chicken cacciatore. And by the time Frosty's wife got home, the chicken cacciatore was all over the ceiling and the walls, and so my father had to leave. Whatever clarity I have about my childhood was, I'm sure, constructed later. After rethinking events, after I had more information and a little more perspective. I know from reading a postcard that my father took a bus across the country to Bremerton, Washington, where he stayed with his mother, Grandma Musa, for a while. On the postcard he wrote, "The bus ride was a killer, but I made it." In a few months, he lost contact with everyone, even his mother.
As a writing teacher, your book, not surprisingly, is about revision. in the parts of ourselves we're searching for in others, the idea of shaping fragments and worldviews into a narrative, the idea of using stories to piece back the reality of what happened.
Before I started the memoir project, I had done a book called Storytelling in Alcoholics Anonymous, a rhetorical analysis, and you can guess from the subtitle that that's an academic book. And I spent about 3.5 years attending open AA meetings, Al-Anon meetings, some NA meetings to learn about the culture of AA. And then I studied how people in AA tell their stories. One of the things I discovered from how people in AA tell their stories is there are a lot of voices in their stories. So they will be saying, well, this is what I said back when I was drinking, and this is what someone said to me. And the voices play off of each other. So when I started to write my memoir, part of what I wanted to try and capture was some of that sense of the multiple voices. Apparently, my father's drinking didn't fit the pattern of most alcoholics. He was a binge drinker. My mother said he could go for a while having only a few drinks every night. Then he would start a binge and be gone for weeks. I can see why he thought he wasn't an alcoholic. One of the things I tried very hard to do was when I was quoting a text that had the words of my father, my brother, my mother, I tried to let those stand independently. I tried to keep those words from becoming immersed in and overshadowed by the overarching narrative, which was what I was writing.
In 2002, you began a search for your father, 28 years after his death. You write about how your mother's last memory was your first memory. Would you tell us about that moment?
Yeah, that's something that I wrote about in a very early chapter in the memoir. My first memory was from when I was about 3 or 3.5 years old. And what I remembered was crawling out of my playpen. Our family was living at the time on a military base. It was actually an island not too far from New York City. And I crawled out of the playpen. And I have this memory of walking across the parade field looking for my father. Where I eventually wound up was walking along a seawall. And the seawall was only a few inches above the ground on the land side, but then it dropped to about 10 or 12 feet to some rocks on the ocean side. So that was my first memory. What I call my mother's last memory occurred when she was in a nursing home. She was suffering from Alzheimer's, and for several weeks she walked up and down the halls very agitated, very distressed, and she kept saying, "I've lost my boy, I've lost my boy." For the longest time I couldn't figure out what she meant by that, and I tried to reassure her and to say to her, you know, I'm your boy, I'm your baby, I'm right here. But of course, I was a grown man at the time. But it just seemed like nothing relieved her. And I don't know why it took me so long to make the connection, but I think she was remembering that day when I was lost and potentially in danger. One of the things I did in that early chapter was connect these two memories. But it was also a way of looking at memory itself. In the winter of 1958, about a year and a half after we had moved to Virginia Beach, my father came home late on a Sunday night. My brother and I ran to the door yelling, "Daddy, Daddy." He had been gone for several weeks and returned with not a dime. I would guess he had stayed gone as long as the money lasted, until he could no longer find anyone to buy him a drink. Until he had to sober up and return home, ashamed, like a little boy. My mother emptied her purse to pay the cab driver, who seemed as embarrassed as my father. I remember the cab driver apologized again and again. Of course, none of this was the cabbie's fault. but he had still felt bad about taking the woman's last dollar. When my mother put me to bed, she looked sad. I asked her, "Are we out of money?" She said, "No, we have some more in the bank." But something was clearly wrong. I think that was the night, the moment she made her decision. Which is something that most memoirs, current memoirs, do. At some point, they question memories. They test them out. They say, could it actually have happened this way? And that might be going through documents and finding places where we've altered our memories. Or it might be something as simple as just thinking it through and realizing it couldn't have happened.
You use photographs as a way to help us understand your father. You write, "Sometimes photographs, no matter how carefully staged, reveal something of the feelings that normally remain hidden." Could you tell us about how looking at the photographs helped you to understand him?
Well, I would say throughout the memoirs, I use a number of what could generally be called artifacts. Some of those are text, journals, letters, my father's military records. But some of the artifacts were also photographs. What I had found in my family's papers were what I thought were multiple copies of the same family portrait. And what I eventually came to realize once I started looking at them closely is that it wasn't all just multiple copies of one photograph. It was actually four different photographs with subtle changes. And basically what I think the story is that my family wanted a family portrait, one of those 1950s family portraits that says, "We are a normal family, normal middle-class family, we're happy, things are going really well," and you can send that off to the relatives, and they think that everything is going well. I'm pretty sure my father had a friend of his bring in a Navy camera and lights, set it up in our living room, and started taking photographs. Even with the first photograph, there's a little bit of tension, but then by the last photograph, my brother is bawling. I'm pretty sure what happened is my brother couldn't sit still. My father got agitated and started yelling at him. He started bawling. My mother was embarrassed. It was just a disastrous day. But what I find intriguing about that is we just couldn't pull things together for 15 or 20 minutes to get one good family portrait. So I think that said a lot about what was going on in my family at the time. When I was growing up, when I needed a father, I don't think those expressions of love or good intentions would have meant much. I needed the actions, the presence of a father. Now it helps. I'm not sure how or why, but it helps. When I think of my family, I feel loss and sadness, but not anger. Things have not, however, settled down. I cannot rethink my father's story without changing, and I cannot change without rethinking my father's story.
George Jensen is the author of Some of the Words Are Theirs, a memoir of an alcoholic family, published by Moon City Press. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to this special Father's Day program of Arts and Letters. We'll be back in a moment.
To Beaver.
Your father did very well in school, and I got good grades. You had a grandfather that was a professor. Why, he was considered practically a genius.
Yeah, it's nice having all that smart stuff in the family, Mom. I just hope it didn't all get worn out before it came to me.
This is Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and we're talking with George Jensen. So much of your book is about artifacts, and not just artifacts of your father's papers and letters and photographs, but also reconstructing a kind of life through television shows and movies.
Part of what I was trying to do with the references to television shows and movies and other events is build a little bit of the cultural context of the time that I was growing up. So as I was doing revisions, I kept adding those kind of cultural references in. Certainly one of the contrasts that gets played up quite a bit is that whenever you're referring to the culture at the time when I was growing up, and basically in the 1950s and 60s, there weren't many abnormal families on television. There were pretty much a mom and a dad and two kids. Well, we had the mom and the two kids, but we didn't have the dad. We were very clearly not a normal family. So if I were watching something like Leave It to Beaver, that show was in stark contrast to my family life. At one point, I write about how June Cleaver comes through the kitchen every night with a pie. And my mother, I don't think, ever baked a pie in her whole life. But she worked two or three jobs and supported the family. She cleaned the house. She did pretty much everything. She did cook, but she couldn't quite cook as well as June Cleaver. So in viewing television shows, it just seemed like every message there was that we were not a normal family.
I'll give you a hint as to where we are going today, Sherman. What do I have in my hand?
A pitcher of water.
What do I have in my other hand?
A pitcher of Uncle Louie.
Correct. Now I hold the pitcher over the picture. What am I going to do?
Looks like you're going to water Uncle Louie.
Almost, Sherman. We are going to water Lou.
You say that you wanted to be Peabody in Rocky and Friends, yeah. But you felt more like Sherman.
Well, I don't know how many people remember the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. One of the segments on Rocky and Bullwinkle was Mr. Peabody's improbable history. And Mr. Peabody and Sherman would go back in time to some event like the Battle of Waterloo and make sure that things turned out okay. Mr. Peabody was a very intellectual, smart, in-control dog. And Sherman was a little boy who was always befuddled and pretty confused and totally incompetent. And in some ways, he was Mr. Peabody's pet, even though he was the boy and Mr. Peabody was the dog. I always wanted to be in control like Mr. Peabody, but I was pretty sure I was perpetually befuddled like Sherman.
You found letters that your father had written to your mother.
I would first say that I grew up thinking at some point in my childhood, and I think this was just something I needed to do in order to survive. I told myself, well, my father obviously doesn't care about me. He's an alcoholic. He cares more about the bottle than he does about his family. So I don't care about him. As I was leaving my teen years, I often said to myself, I will be a better man than my father. I felt that I wanted to move past the man that I believed my father to be. That made it easier for me to just move through adolescence and into adulthood. Shortly after Donna and I began dating, as we were in the early stages of learning about each other's family history, I gave her one of my versions of my simple story. I told her my father was an alcoholic. My parents were divorced when I was 6. I never saw my father again. At some point, that got questioned as I started looking at documents, and one in particular, which I would say is really at the core of the whole book, was a letter that my father wrote to my mother shortly after he left the family. And in fact, I didn't even find this letter. My wife found the letter in my mother's papers, and I was working at my computer, working on a book. She came in and said, read this. And I said, yeah, I'll read it in a little while. And she said, no, read this right now. In the 2 or 3 minutes it took me to read the letter, I think my whole view of my whole family shifted. Because in this letter, my father was talking about being away from the family, how much he missed the kids, how much he missed my mother, how my mother was the only woman in the world for him, how he would never marry anyone else, how he was a few nights earlier at a point where he was thinking about committing suicide. And this was not the man that I imagined in my own mind without any evidence. So once I saw the letter, I had to really rethink who he was. I was 24 and in graduate school when my mother called without any warning to say my father had died. I expressed some shock on the phone, but I didn't really feel anything. We made a trip to New Orleans, a family trip to New Orleans. My wife said, well, we need to go down there and see what we can find. And she located his cemetery, which was in a national cemetery in Baton Rouge. So one of the things we did is we actually went and found his grave and went to his grave, left stones on his headstone, marking that someone has been there and someone has cared about that person. And then we went on down to New Orleans. I had one of the addresses from some documents where he lived and went and found that address. It was sort of a hotel with a courtyard. The sign outside of the hotel said that if there's a problem about trash collection, contact this person, and had his name. What I did when I went back to the hotel room was I started looking through the phone book for people with that name. Actually found several, made some calls, but eventually talked to that guy whose family had owned that hotel or boarding house. My father had lived there, and he remembered my father. And they owned a bar next to that boarding house. Now, he was about 12 years old at the time, so we have to question the accuracy of his memories. But he always thought that my father was just a social drinker and had very kind things to say about him. One of the things he said about my father is that he helped his friends out a lot. So if he had money, he gave part of his money to his friends. But it was interesting that at least his image of my father was that he was not a heavy drinker, that he was just a social drinker. My family history seems to say that my father was an alcoholic, but I cannot even say this with certainty. And I'm not sure I even want certainty any longer.
What did you find that you thought about your father that wasn't true?
Well, I think in general, I began to question everything. At points, I even questioned that he was an alcoholic, and that could possibly be true. He was in World War II. He was at Pearl Harbor when it was bombed. His ship, the USS Dewey, was in almost every major battle of the South Pacific. So he saw a lot of action, and I'm sure he came back with some PTSD, or what would now be called PTSD. And I'm sure that part of what he was doing was self-medicating. Now, it might be that toward the end of his life, maybe that got better enough that he didn't drink quite as heavily. So I don't know. It was good to have questions, though.
Mm-hmm. After the search, after finding in some ways what happened, after reconstructing your imagined sense of what happened, what's the Sermon on Love trying to tell us?
Well, that's the last chapter of the book. And what I wanted to do there was just talk about how researching the stories of members of my family gave me greater appreciation for everything they had been through, all of their struggles, and that it left me at a place with love. Love, fear, and laughter all appear to be part of our evolution, remnants of our collective survival. Psychologists are starting to realize that it is laughter that moves us from fear to love, and this is part of the structure of the brain, essential to what it means to be a human being. Laughter reduces stress and elevates our immune system. It also brings us together. This I learned from listening to old-timers at AA meetings. Reading psychology only confirmed it. I've given up on my simple story for the complex stories of my father, mother, and brother, for stories that reflect their lives as lived apart from our family. These are not stories that can be shaped into a single narrative. Yet even though their stories must be told separately, the process of coming to these stories is part of a larger movement. This book has been about questioning assumptions, listening to the words of others, and trying to understand what is always beyond our grasp. It is about learning to care, and caring exists somewhere beyond certainty, and sharing our stories, even if all we can tell are bits and pieces.
Our next memoir, Before I Sleep, a memoir of travel and reconciliation written by Frank Thurmond, a literature instructor at UALR, will take us from Arkansas to Oxford, England, and back to Arkansas again, during which time Frank meets his birth father for the first time.
It was a fine May afternoon, the kind of day that makes a whole year's worth of English weather worth the wait. I walked down the street to a small park in Wellington Square and sat in the grass beneath an enormous old oak. I looked at my watch. 45 minutes. In 45 minutes, the phone on my desk would be ringing, and on the other end of the line would be the voice of my father. A voice I had never known in my conscious life. What would it sound like? What would he say? What would I say? These were questions that must have been buried within me my whole lifetime up to that moment, along with the ever-haunting question of his absence. Everything else that had preoccupied my mind only a day earlier, before my mother's call, had vanished.
Frank Thurmond, scholar, musician, filmmaker, author, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
While you were at Oxford studying literature, you get a call from your mother that your birth father is on his deathbed and wishes to speak to you.
Yeah, well, I was just doing my usual routine, studying and preparing for classes and so forth, and the phone rings, and it was my mom, and it wasn't the usual day she always called me, so I was a little bit surprised. And then there was a sound of concern in her voice. What she told me completely changed my life at that moment. She said that she had heard from my father, and he was dying on his deathbed, and that he wanted to connect with me. The reason that was so powerful is because I hadn't known my father my whole life. My parents had split when I was about 3. At that point, I had just reached my 30th birthday, and I was really starting to have a crisis about that, wondering who is my father? Where is he? I knew he must still be alive because I figured I'd be told if he wasn't. And I really was starting to feel this emptiness just grow inside, wondering who he was. So when my mother told me she had heard from him, he was going to call me, it just really just completely transformed my life at that moment. Everything else that had preoccupied my mind only a day earlier, before my mother's call, had vanished. It was as if all my daily concerns, the day-to-day reality that normally seemed so damned important, had melted away in the mist of memory. Memories of earliest childhood, long forgotten, flooded my mind as a lifetime of experiences flashed before my mind's eye like the fabled moment of death. In the park, the summer roses were in full bloom. I walked over to a rose bush and inhaled, slowly, deeply and deliberately, its pungent sweetness. As I bent down and smelled each rose in turn, their redolence transported me to a place nearly forgotten outside of dreams.
Your dream journey takes us to Crossit, where you lived as a young child for a while with your mother and your maternal grandparents.
Just after my parents' separation, before my mother remarried, I went to Crossit, Arkansas with my mother, back to her parents' farm. And so my earliest memories really come from that experience on the farm. And so my real father figure early on was my grandfather, Daddy Frank. And he and my grandmother, Mama Doris, just really took me in and gave me that sense of family that I clearly needed at that point. And that experience has always remained for me a magical part of early childhood, thanks to my grandparents.
You begin your first chapter, seeing the farm and Crossit, from the point of view of you as a toddler.
The sound of clippers stirred me from my reverie, and I looked to see my grandmother resuming her work in the garden. She was pruning the rose bushes. I ran over to her, delighting in the flowers' radiant colors after the rain. Pink, white, yellow, and scarlet red, all dripping with sunlit sparkle of rainwater. I watched her curiously. A window air conditioning unit whirred to life, and I knew my grandfather must be up from his nap. I excitedly jumped from the swing and ran across the yard as fast as my 3-year-old legs would carry me, up the wooden front steps and into the front hall of the old house. And I could already hear my grandfather inside tapping his pipe on the glass ashtray. In the living room, my grandfather had just settled into his new reclining chair by the window, and as usual, focused immediately on filling his pipe from a small red tin of Prince Albert tobacco. I sat contentedly on the old red couch next to my grandfather in his chair, savoring the smell of his tobacco and the gentle hum of the air conditioner. I still wasn't sure where my mother was, but here inside with my grandfather, I felt safe.
We'll be back with more of Frank Thurman's memoir of travel and reconciliation on Arts and Letters after this short break. Welcome back to Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and we're talking with Frank Thurman about his memoir, Before I Sleep. As a teenager, you immerse yourself in music, particularly the bass guitar.
At that moment, someone pushed a button to open the curtain, and I watched as it gradually parted to reveal the packed auditorium beyond the spotlight. I nearly collapsed from fear, but refocused attention on my playing, finding it all I could do just to keep my fingers working the thick bass strings. Music became a big part of my life in high school, but then I had some great high school English teachers who inspired my love of reading, which was remarkable because I'd grown up as a dyslexic and always had reading difficulties, and yet by the time I finished high school, I loved literature. And even though it took me a long time to read it, I just couldn't get enough of it. And so I actually went on to major in English, of all things, with that experience. And so I combined English and music all through college, and there came a point after I finished college with a bachelor's in English but minor in music, where I had to decide if I wanted to pursue English or music. And I had two very interesting choices to make at one point. I'd always dreamed of studying at Oxford, and I had applied, and I'd had some hope that I might get in with references I had and so forth. But I also had been offered the opportunity to study music in the graduate program at Yale. I had met the classical guitarist who was head of the guitar program at Yale, and had said he would admit me. So I just decided, okay, the great dream was always to go abroad to England and study English at Oxford. If I get into Oxford, I will go there. If not, I'll go to Yale and study music. So I just had a period of time there where everything was up in the air, but I just made that choice just to let fate decide. And when I did get accepted into Oxford, that's what I did. New students gathered in the master's lodgings for the centuries-old tradition of signing the college admissions register. Upon entering the imposing old house tucked away in the back of the college, I was warmly greeted by the master himself, Professor John Albury, who directed me to the line of students waiting to sign the book. When I reached the book of admissions, on display next to it was an ancient-looking leather-bound volume open to the page where poet Percy Bysshe Shelley had signed his own name in 1810. Along with their autograph, students were expected to write out a detailed declaration involving their parentage and place of origin. But whereas Shelley and his contemporaries had been expected to do this in fluent Latin, we could fortunately write in modern English. Once I'd completed this exercise, I turned to see the master making his rounds among the guests with a pitcher of punch, refilling glasses while chatting with individual students. From the moment I met him, I was immediately struck by the master's natural exuberance. Tall and stout, albeit with a healthy paunch and a distinguished mop of white hair, he possessed the air of the senior professor he was. "Frank, isn't it?" he said. "From the States, I presume. And from which state, may I ask?" "Arkansas," I answered. Before my father called, first thing I said to my mother was, I'll fly back and meet him. Maybe I should meet him just before he dies. And my mother was immediately against it. And she said, well, why should you come back and meet him when he's not been there for you? And then she suddenly revealed to me that he had been living up the road from us all those years. Now, the interesting thing is I'd never been able to talk to my mother about my father. So for some reason, it was like a taboo subject. At one time in high school, she had said, the time's probably not yet right, but one day when you're ready, you'll know when it's the right time to find him. And so all those years had gone by, and I'd not made an effort to find him. I hadn't felt ready, but then he found me. So I decided my brother was right, and it probably was best not to bother trying to fly all the way back to meet him.
Your friend tells you to go.
I met up with one of my oldest friends who was there at Oxford with me. He was an American from the South, and we really connected. And he simply said, you have to go. You have to go meet your father. He explained to me that he had lost his own father prematurely, and he just simply said, if you don't meet your father, you'll always regret it. Get on the next flight home and meet him. And he convinced me. But it was certainly one of the hardest decisions of my life. But after speaking with my friend, I didn't hesitate. I bought a ticket, and I made it back just in time to meet him.
You rush back to Little Rock, take that long plane trip. What happens?
Well, I knew that the first challenge I had to work through, and I thought about it the whole flight back, was what I would say to my adopted father, because he was and is my dad, who had always been there for me, and I'd just come to think of him as my father, and for long periods of time, I would forget all about my biological father and just had a dad. So I wanted to think about how I would explain to him what I was about to do, and also my brother and sister, who were children by my adopted father, and I knew I would have a dinner that night when I got back, where I had to get it just right. I had to figure out exactly what to say. And so the eve before going to meet my father, you know, I had that dinner with my family and I explained what I was doing and why the best way I could. And the most important thing was that my adopted father, Russell Thurman, just looked at me and said, you're doing the right thing, son. You have to achieve this sense of closure. My old school friend Robert offered to travel with me from Little Rock to Hot Springs so I wouldn't have to journey there alone. We drove up the day before my appointment with my father and stayed the night in a hotel on Lake Hamilton. Then the next day, we drove to the house where my father had lived with his girlfriend and her family for many years. I was greeted in the front yard by a man of about my own age named Randall. I know exactly what you're experiencing, he said. I met my own birth father later in life too. By the time we entered the house, Randall explained how he was brought up in turn by my biological father like a son of his own. My father had otherwise had no further children.
Then you go to meet your dad. You opened the door and you'd never seen the house?
You know, I didn't know what to expect, but I arrived at the house and the family who were there, my father had not remarried, but he had a long-term girlfriend and her family that lived there, and they were very welcoming, immediately made me feel comfortable and took me in to meet him. And so I had that moment of being with my father alone and having a chance to speak with him.
What did he say to you?
Well, it's, I think the most interesting thing was we found a shared interest in literature. I didn't know what to say, but I knew an attempt at small talk would seem, under the circumstances, pathetic. But he spoke first. He said, "You're studying English literature?" I could tell from his voice that his health had already declined rapidly since our brief phone conversation 3 days earlier. "Yes, I'm studying medieval and Renaissance drama." Then, to my surprise, he began to recite Chaucer in Middle English. "One that apler with the shatter suta, the druit of March hath persed to the ruta." I suddenly realized the room we were in was a private study full of books. There were books everywhere, with every imaginable title, from Dostoevsky to Chomsky to a treatise on the art of growing marijuana. I simply mentioned that I was studying Renaissance literature, and he suddenly started quoting literature to me, and I quoted it back, some Shakespeare to him. He quoted Chaucer in Middle English, I quoted Shakespeare, and he nodded and knew the quote, and I even found out that his whole reason for wanting to connect with me was expressed in his quote from Robert Frost's poem, "Stopping My Woods on a Snowy Evening," which has the line, "You know, I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep." And it turned out that my father had quoted that to his family, and I realized that he was trying to keep his own promises to me before I sleep. "Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flakes. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep." It was clear that our conversation was becoming extremely difficult for him. I looked into his eyes and was struck by a strange sense of familiarity, and then realized his eyes seemed the mirror image of my own. Yet they now betrayed something else, too, something he would finally express before we said goodbye. It seemed an appropriate moment for bringing the visit to a close. I told my father simply how glad I was finally to have met him. I told him that I would one day write about our meeting, so that this occasion and he would not be forgotten. It was now my turn to quote poetry, and I recalled two lines which seemed to fit the sentiment perfectly. "So long as men can breathe, our eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee." My father nodded. Then I said, "I want you to know that as you are my father, I love you." Just as I was about to leave, he seemed to be struggling to summon up one last word. "Don't die bitter," he said. Then he looked deeply into my eyes before saying the last words I would ever hear from him. "I regret." With this, he abruptly dropped his chin to his chest with a look of final resignation. As I turned away, my eyes filled with tears, and when they saw my face, the women in the room began to weep. Randall accompanied me outside where Robert was waiting at the car, and I thanked him for helping make my visit such a warm one. Then Monica came out and said she had something for me from my father. "He insisted on this," she said, handing me a check to cover the cost of my trip from London. On the check he had written, "For love and travel." The next day, Randall called to say my father had died that night. He spent the last few days of his life trying to tie up all the loose ends before you arrived, Randall explained. We told him he should just rest and save energy, and that we'd take care of everything. Yet he insisted and just kept saying, "But I have promises to keep." I smiled and then recited softly to myself, "And miles to go before I sleep."
And then you found out that he passed away the next day. But he bequeathed his library to you.
That's right. He had a whole library of books, but he didn't have anyone in his immediate family or, you know, in his life who cared about books. And he suddenly found that the one son he had loved books and had that connection with him, and he left me all of his books. From his books, I get to see so many of his interests. I mean, everything you can imagine, from classic works of literature, poetry, to philosophy, to archaeology, which was a real interest of his, and just everything in between. Suddenly, I was able to open up with my mom for the first time and talk to her and ask her what had happened and find out why they had separated and just have all the questions answered that I'd always had. And this really created a greater closeness between me and my mother as well, to finally be able to talk about my father after, you know, over 30 years.
So you went back to Oxford?
Then I went back and just had a whole new...
How did it change you?
I just think that, I realized that I'd been weighed down for a number of years by not knowing my father and who he was and where he was and so forth. And as I mentioned earlier, that had really started to come front and center in my thoughts as I passed my 30th birthday. So I just felt I could really move on in a way that I'd not been able to before as a person. It was just after meeting my father that I then had that incredible experience of playing lute for the Queen, which came just afterwards. So you can imagine what a year that was. Yet somehow that almost seemed symbolic of this new level I'd reached, been able to get beyond the doubt and fear and sadness about not knowing who my father was, and then have such an incredible opportunity, which just remains in my memory just one of full of light and joy. Everyone knew that the Queen was due to visit the college in May as the highlight of the celebrations. I, like most students, was simply hoping for a glimpse of royalty. But now I found myself actually preparing to be presented to Her Majesty in person, along with a musical performance. When the big day arrived, I'd been versed in advance in royal protocol. The first time one is addressed by the Queen, the appropriate response should include "Your Majesty." After that, it's generally "Yes, ma'am," or "No, ma'am," something I could easily remember as a well-bred Southerner. The master had organized a reception in the master's garden for college fellows and various distinguished guests, and it asked me to perform appropriately Elizabethan pieces on my lute as the Queen and Prince Philip entered the garden from the master's lodgings. As I sat on the garden bench warming up, the thrill I experienced upon first seeing the Queen is indescribable. As the master and lady butler escorted the Queen and Prince Philip into the garden, I continued performing as I heard the master introducing me. Then on cue, I stood up as the Queen came towards me with her outstretched, white-gloved hand. I took her hand gently and then bowed slightly with my lute, feeling in my colorful academic regalia like a medieval minstrel if there ever was one. The Queen was dressed in a bright yellow suit, complemented with a yellow hat to match. Then the Queen asked, "Is that a real Elizabethan lute?" "No, Your Majesty," I replied. "This is a replica, as there are no surviving complete Elizabethan lutes." This had gone well. But then Prince Philip decided to offer a comment of his own. "I think they've got some complete Elizabethan lutes at the Victoria and Albert Museum," said the prince. I suppose, to be politically correct, I should have simply said, oh yes, you're right, Your Royal Highness, in fact there are. But instead I waxed academic and proceeded to explain that there were no, in fact, completely intact Renaissance lutes. Having just contradicted the prince added an element of tension to the proceedings. But fortunately the master, a consummate diplomat, stepped in, and I was greatly relieved that his comment appeared to side with me in the matter. "Surely the wooden frame wouldn't have survived that long," said the master. Then the Queen tactfully changed the subject to allow me a graceful exit. "But you were playing Elizabethan music then?" "Yes, ma'am," I replied, and with a pleasant laugh, the royal couple continued on their way to the garden party. I sat back on the bench with my lute, took a deep breath, and smiled, knowing I'd just had yet another extraordinary experience to treasure a lifetime.
So what did your memoir teach you and your odyssey and your meeting with your father? And
it took me about 10 years to even share this story with people. And I realized that it's not just about me. It's not about my story. It's a universal theme, connecting with, in this case, a parent that one hasn't known, or in some cases, I had parents coming up and telling me that reminded them that it was probably time for them to reconnect with children that they had lost touch with. So I realized that just sharing the story, my own personal story, was therapeutic for me, you could say, just writing it all out, but also meant something to others and got people thinking more deeply about their own lives.
Where is my father, the one who was to raise me?
Frank Thurman's memoir, Before I Sleep, is available from Atalia Press. George Jensen's memoir, Some of the Words Are Theirs, is available from Moon City Press. Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to Lauren and Micah Sukhani, whose band, The Damsels in Distress, supplied the soundtrack for the show. Thank you to Odyssey for rocking us out, and to George Jensen and Frank Thurman for their intricate guitar stylings. A big shout out to the amazingly talented Mr. Chris Hickey, who produced the show. Thank you, Dr. George Jensen from the Department of Rhetoric and Writing, and Mr. Frank Thurman from the English Department. On behalf of the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences, a heartfelt Father's Day thank you. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, recalling the words of poet Robert Frost. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference.